Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be back. That's a picture of my daughter just to prove I have done something in the last year useful. She's 7 weeks old now. There we go. Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit about Galilean theories, which probably most of you have heard about, and their problems. And this is my attempt, this is going to be somewhat conjectural, but my attempt to understand the various issues with Galileans that I'll discuss, and specifically whether to what extent they can be UV completed. So although, I guess this is the cosmology seminar, right? So most of the motivation for thinking about Galileans comes from cosmological theories, particularly infrared modified theories of gravity. But I'm actually not going to talk too much about cosmology in this talk. It's really, in fact, I'm not going to talk about it at all. This is really sort of to try and understand what role these theories play and whether they really make sense. So, in fact, the original Galilean model came from the decoupling limit of the DGP model, Dvalli-Ghebredati-Perotti model, which was a particular brain world model in extra dimensions. And they've since been found to universally arrive in various massive gravity theories. In fact, basically any infrared modified theory of gravity in which the graviton effectively acquires a mass, either in a hard way or a soft way, will have as some limit Galileans as an effective field theory. And what the Galilean field is, which is usually called pi in this context, is it basically describes the helicity zero mode of the massive graviton. So in four dimensions, a massive graviton will have 5 degrees of freedom. Two of those are helicity two modes, the normal ones of GR. There's two vectors whose dynamics is not too interesting. And there's always one extra scalar mode, which is what looks like the Galilean decoupling limit. And just viewed as a scalar field theory, we can define a Galilean to be the effective field theory of a single scalar field. Although, of course, you can always generalize this, but we'll just keep things as simple. A single scalar field with the following nonlinearly realized symmetry, which is called the Galilean symmetry, which is a combination of a shift symmetry, nothing particularly surprising there, but also this space-time dependent symmetry. It's still a global symmetry, of course, because the parameter v mu is a constant, but you can shift the field pi by something linear in x mu, and the action remains invariant. And then following your rules, effective field theory rules, you should simply write down every single operator. Do you have a pointer at all?
The hockey stick.
The hockey stick? I can't see it. You should write down every single operator consistent with that symmetry because you expect every single operator to be generated by integrating out whatever high energy physics gives rise to this low energy effective field theory. That would be the normal story. And there are a finite set of terms, which I've written schematically like that. I'll show you what that is in a little bit, but these are Levi-Civita symbols. I'm wedging together various combinations of this Galilean invariant combination, dd pi. And there's only a finite number of those terms in any dimension d.
And
in flat space, yes, yes. Are appropriately called West Zumino terms, which you can ask Kurt about if you want to know more about that. It's the Minkowski metric. I'll show the terms in a bit. And then, of course, as always, as in any effective field theory, expect an infinite number of higher derivative terms, which I've just schematically written as pi to the m derivatives to the 2n, but really I mean by all various contractions of derivatives acting on pi at any given order, and so on. Or all suppressed by the scale lambda in the theory. So that's how you would view it as an effective field theory. And just to clarify what those West Zumino terms are in this notation, this guy is the normal Levi-Civita symbol, so we're just simply contracting together this Galilean invariant combination, dd pi, with the Minkowski metric, with basically pairing up the indices in such a way that it's not just zero because of antisymmetry. And then there's one pi sitting out front, and that pi sitting out front means the Lagrangian is not manifestly invariant under the symmetry, but the action is, which prompts the interpretation of West Zumino terms. So there's no problem computing tree amplitudes and loops perturbatively in effective field theory. And I think for a special Galilean model, Freddie has an answer for like all the tree amplitudes. Is that right? And there's no problem doing that. And if you just view it as an effective field theory and don't think too much beyond that, everything is great. There's no problem computing anything. It happens that these finite number of terms are not renormalized. That's essentially because they're not manifestly Galilean invariant. So no loop corrections will renormalize these coefficients here. But this infinite number of terms are renormalized. So if you choose some Wilsonian cutoff scale or dimreg or whatever you want to do, these things will run under that scale, but these guys won't. But still, it's just an effective field theory which breaks down at some scale lambda. So up to the scale lambda, everything looks great. We can make sense of it. Perturbation theory breaks down at that scale. So what is just an effective field theory? Who's to say there's not some consistent UV completion of this theory? Well, the problem is, in fact, you can say that. You can show that there is no local Lorentz invariant unitary UV completion of the Galilean theories. So they're not low-energy effective field theories of any local Lorentz invariant unitary completion. So another way of saying that is that we could not think of this scale lambda as coming from, say, some mass of a heavy particle like a Higgs that we've integrated out to generate all those operators. It's simply not possible. There is no local UV completion. And the argument for that, just to remind you why that's true, let's go back to what we know about field theory. So in a local field theory, then operators commutes outside the light cone. That's really part of its definition. And from this assumption, you can derive, the just Lehmann-Dyson representation, which is a statement that if you take the commutator between two fields, x minus x, sandwich it between two momenta eigenstates in the system, then the just Lehmann-Dyson representation says I can always write that as a linear superposition of Minkowski space of free field commutators. And each one of these certainly vanishes outside the light cone. And then I just have a superposition of those. The superposition depends on space because you're not in vacuum. So it's a little bit like thinking of an arbitrary state as being like a vacuum here and a vacuum here with different coefficients. So this depends on space. And it depends on this spectral mass parameter, which we'll see more of later. But it is clear that just because this thing vanishes outside the light cone, as long as this integral converges, then this thing vanishes outside the light cone, which is what was used in deriving that representation. And from this representation, you can prove that the forward scattering amplitude, the 2-2 scattering amplitude, for example, and also the scattering amplitude for any physical momentum transfer, t less than zero, is an analytic function in the complex S-plane. So this is the famous dispersion relations that go back to the 50s and so on. And you can prove it's analytic, and there's only a finite number of subtractions in that dispersion relation. And I'll explain in a bit what a subtraction is if you're not sure. But basically, that comes from the fact that in a local field theory, this function grows only polynomially in mu. So the integral actually technically, to make the amplitude converge, you actually have to perform a number of subtractions, which I'll get to in a second. You can also prove in a local field theory this important property of polynomial boundedness of the S matrix. So the origin of this is that in a local field theory, the Wightmann functions, which are defined, so Wightmann function is just the non-time ordered expectation value of all the operators, just the correlation functions without time ordering, and this is the Fourier transform of those. So the statement of the Wightmann functions are tempered distributions, which is built into the Wightmann axioms that define axiomatic field theory. They cannot grow faster than a polynomial in K. That's the temperedness assumption, and that follows, you can prove that, follows for a local field theory. And then because the Wyman functions basically determine the scattering amplitude after time ordering and so on, then, to cut a long story short, then the scattering amplitude also cannot grow faster than a polynomial for any complex K. So that doesn't just mean for the real physical values, for all complex K, fully analytically continued, the amplitude can't grow faster than a polynomial. And so that is the statement that the scattering amplitude in a local field theory is polynomially bounded. And then from the polynomial boundedness assumption, Foisard, he used the Mandelson representation, which requires a special assumption, but then Martin improved it. From the polynomial boundedness, you can prove, in fact, that the number of subtractions in that dispersion relation is never more than 2, because, in fact, the amplitude in the forward scattering limit cannot grow as an arbitrary polynomial. In fact, it cannot grow any faster than s log s squared, which means it's bounded by s squared. So you don't need any more than 2 subtractions. And this is the famous Foisard bound, or sometimes Foisard-Martin bound, which gives a bound on the growth of the cross-section in any theory, at least with a mass gap. Now, if the theory doesn't have a mass gap, if it's massless, then the bound actually only says that this grows, the amplitude doesn't grow faster than a polynomial in a local field theory. But we'll assume that we will destroy the Galilean by adding a little mass. It breaks the symmetry, but I can make the mass as small as I want, so I don't break the symmetry significantly, and I'm still subject to this particular bound. So what then the dispersion relation means is that the statement that the scattering amplitude for 2-2 scattering is an analytic function means I can write a dispersion relation like this. I should have drawn a picture, but this is the statement that the scattering amplitude is an analytic function everywhere in the complex plane, except for possible poles and a branch cut extending from 4m squared out to infinity and from 0 out to minus infinity. So one branch cut is because of this integral when the denominator goes through 0 here. The second branch cut is because of this integral. And the discontinuity across the branch cut is the imaginary part of the scattering amplitude, which is related to the cross section. And as I said, this thing technically actually doesn't exist because the scattering amplitude grows as a polynomial. So you have to perform what are called subtractions, where you separate out the first few terms and rewrite the dispersion like this. And so the Foisard bound implies that there are only 2 subtractions, which means I only need to take 2 of those coefficients out there. Now, when I subtract something, it means that it was naively infinite, so I can't actually say what that value is. It's like a renormalization constant. Okay? So essentially, there's two free unknown things, but the rest is known. The rest of this junk, if you know what the imaginary part of the amplitude is, then you know this whole thing. You don't know these 2 a priori, but you know the rest of it. That's right.
But for the Galilean with the shift symmetry, there's no relevant operators.
Well, everything is irrelevant, I guess. But clearly in the case of Galileans, you have to redo your counting, yeah. You have to think of it in a different way.
I would think in that case there should be no subtraction needed.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. But we can talk more about that later, but yeah. But here I'm just running with the, I don't think that's true, but. Okay, so here we are, we got the dispersion relation with 2 subtractions, and then neglecting the pole terms, if you differentiate this twice and evaluate it at 0, then you get this simple integral. And the key point is that the argument of this integral is actually positive because the imaginary part of the scattering amplitude is determined by the cross-section. By the optical theorem, the imaginary part is S times the cross-section, at least at large S. So the argument here is positive. It's positive at all S. And so A double prime at S is 0 is a positive number. And so this argument was used by Adams et al. In 2006, and this was in the days of the DGP before people use the term Galilean, but in fact it applies to all Galilean models. If you compute for the Galilean the lowest order scattering amplitude, it can be written like s cubed plus t cubed plus u cubed. And for that model, clearly just because it starts at cubic order, in the massless limit, a prime prime is 0, but that violates this condition. So a prime prime has to be positive from the assumptions that we made, and therefore it is simply not possible UV complete the Galilean model. And that's true for all Galileans. It is therefore true by extension for any theory that has Galileans as decoupling limits, so like massive gravity and bigravity and all those theories. And so that is the conclusion. Galileans do not admit a local Lorentz invariant UV completion. And that's it. And so I could stop there. Now, what were the assumptions that go into that? So locality and causality imply analyticity through the JLD representation. That you can prove just from the fact that you know locality implies the Joss-Lehmann-Dyson representation. And from that, you can prove analyticity, at least for the forward scattering amplitude. You can't prove maximal analyticity, but you can prove the analyticity used in this argument. Locality implies polynomial boundedness from the temperedness assumption. Again, that you can prove. And polynomial boundedness plus analyticity implies the Poisson-Martin bound. And in the massive case, that's rigorously proven. So all of these statements are quite rigorous and unchangeable. Yeah.
If you just do a phi cube theory, you have it always unbounded from below.
Right.
So you have a phi cube theory with derivatives. So it's even worse.
No, I have a large effective field theory. So that's not the full theory, right? This is only the at the moment, from when I've written down as a low energy effective field theory, I can only take that seriously for when the derivatives are smaller than lambda. So what you really want to know is whether the UV completion has a bounded below. But I'm not telling you what that is.
It's obviously not UV complete.
No. The question, the Galilean is obviously not, what I've written is not UV complete. What the question is that a low energy effective field theory of some theory that is UV complete? And in this argument, I do not require to know what the UV completion is. I'm simply making the assumption that it's local. And that's what the argument's disproving.
So, you did mention this thing about the mass. And I don't know. It seems that you did all of this for finite mass.
Right.
But then, of course, Galileo has zero mass. So I don't really know. You said that you add a small mass. But, of course, then you're breaking the symmetry. So then, how does that mass propagate?
Yeah, the problem is that you break. It's true that you break the symmetry when you add the mass, but there you can clearly show that the terms you get from that breaking of symmetry are still suppressed by the mass. And so the problem is that the corrections to this formula in a massive case all go to zero as m goes to zero. So in order to get around this assumption, you would need something going like 1 over m.
You said this other thing, that if mass is zero, then this Frasovan doesn't hold anymore. It would grow much faster than...
Yeah, it can grow as a polynomial, yeah.
So then that suggests otherwise. So how could something grow as a polynomial but be suppressed as mass?
That's because in the actual bound, what comes in the bound is 1 over m squared. Yeah, going the wrong way here. What comes in the bound is 1 over m squared, so it's not inconsistent. As you take the mass to zero, the actual bound, this goes to infinity.
But if you tried to run the same argument with the strictly massless, you wouldn't be able to carry the argument out? Or?
That's right. If you try it with strictly massless, you can't carry the argument through. In strictly massless case, the amplitude grows as a power of s, and so you simply need to do a dispersion relation with more subtractions, and then there's no contradiction. Which I'll get to in a second.
So the idea is that you start with a small mass and somehow you can keep all the mass corrections and in the limit that's...
Right, so you compute the formula with the small mass and then you take the limit m goes to zero both sides of the formula and then you find a contradiction.
And I guess the question is that would perturbation theory break down at some point? Then you take that limit.
Three-level perturbations don't break down in that limit, right? They remain well-defined. So you'd have to rely on some kind of non-perturbative thing that blows up.
Okay. So the fact that these limits don't commute with each other is that something doesn't.
Right.
Something non-trivial happens. Okay.
Right. That's clearly. So that was always commented as an issue with this. But I have to say that I don't want to rely on an m goes to zero limit. The reason being is that the case I'm most interested in is where these theories are set into things like mass of gravity. And in that case, the Galilean really does have a mass. It's just the only coupling limit. It doesn't have a mass. So for that reason, I'm actually not too interested in the m goes to zero limit. Yeah.
If you put things in historical context, everything you showed to begin with is physics from the early 60s.
That's right.
It's called the 2-Einstein bootstrap program.
That's right.
And with the rise of quarks and the standard model, it faded away. And now we have the Higgs field, which is lambda phi to the fourth, which is renormalizable, da 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 da. So the question is, why are you concerned with Galileans?
That was the first slide.
That was the first slide. So the interest is cosmological for modified theories of gravity. So let's just take it as read. We're interested in Galileans for the rest of the
scale field is not gravity.
No, no, but it arises in infrared modified theories of gravity. That's the issue. Okay, so where did I get to? So that could be you could say that's the end of the road. And many people have taken that point of view. Or you could give something up. And so as I said, at least in the massive case, the only things we assumed were unitarity, Lorentz invariance, and locality. Of course, you never want to give up unitarity. Lorentz invariance is really not desirable to give up because, the motivation for looking at these things was based on Lorentz invariant theories, so Lorentz invariant massive gravity. If you give up Lorentz invariance, then you can actually write down theory of massive gravity in which the list of zero mode doesn't even arise, and so you wouldn't even have to talk about them. So that seems undesirable. But what about locality?
Okay. Maybe I should. So it seems that at the same level that you do get a mass, say for mass theory of gravity, you also break Lorentz invariance because your mass is order Hubble, so you're sitting in an upward avenue universe rather than a Minkowski.
That's a spontaneous breaking. The theory doesn't break Lorentz invariance. PR doesn't break Lorentz invariance.
Well, it does.
No, spontaneously, but not explicitly.
It breaks it spontaneously,
yeah.
Right? But everything that you did here assumed.
But GR is
global Lorentz symmetry.
Right, but if I'm interested in just scattering gravitons, right, in Minkowski space, then the S matrix is Lorentz invariant. GR.
Right.
So that's I'm interested in the same situation. Of course, there are none.
That's hypothetical. Well, I'm saying that the same level that you introduce a mass, you also introduce a real world. The same level that you introduce a mass, you introduce violation of Lorentz, global Lorentz.
You introduce spontaneous breaking, yes.
Right.
That's another story. Okay. So I can still the Galilean theory even with a mass is Lorentz invariant, right? So its S matrix will be.
You can send it right.
Yeah. Okay. So what I'm going to argue is in fact that. Locality is the thing to give up. And in fact, there's already a theory in which we know locality has to be given up to some extent, and that's general relativity. Because in fact, in that case, you already expect the scattering amplitude to violate polynomial boundedness, at least for fixed angle scattering. So you can see that already in the Iconal limit of scattering. So here is just the scattering amplitude for two gravitons scattering into two gravitons, written in the Iconal limit as a function of S and T. And remember that what we're doing is we're looking at this amplitude for all complex S and T. And so there will always be some complex direction for fixed angles when you send S and T off to infinity, for which this thing grows faster than a polynomial for appropriate phase. And that's true in any dimension. So it's already known that from the Iconal limit that the scattering in gravity is expected to violate at least some extent, some degree of polynomial boundedness, which means that gravitational theories never have the properties of local field theories. And in fact, it's also been argued we know less about the scattering amplitude in the region of black hole production, but if you look in the review of Giddings and Porto, they make an ansatz for what you might expect the scattering amplitude to look like. And for in the unphysical momenta transfer region T greater than zero, you expect it to grow exponentially, like the Schwarzschild radius, as a function of the center of mass energy, square root of s, times square root of t, which then will grow exponentially and won't be polynomial bounded. Yeah.
Mathematically speaking, when you have functions coming in which are not polynomially bounded, they're called entire functions. And they have exponential bounds.
Right.
But these have infinite number of derivatives, so it's non-local.
That's right.
So you're saying GR is already non-local.
That's right.
Entire functions.
That's right. Exactly.
That's at the same obvious.
Now, GR is non-local, that's right. The classical action is local, but it has some degree of non-locality in it.
Can you prove this?
Me, no, but somebody can.
And the person will play on me.
So what about string theory amplitudes? Because those are supposed to be softer than any possible field theory amplitude.
Right. So does somebody want to say something about that?
String theory amplitudes are entire functions. So you already have a problem. This has been known for.
That's right. So from what I understand, so I'm not an expert on this. If you're working within the GSG string expansion, you can't see this behavior because you're not in the region of black hole production. So you have one particular behavior there. What is less well known is what's happening in this region.
It's really a non-perturbative
right.
black hole formation.
That's right. So my understanding is even the arguments in string theory, you would expect violation of polynomial boundedness for the scattering amplitude. But somebody can correct me.
But yeah, I mean, so the question is, like, the octonal.
Freddie, do you want to correct me?
I don't want to correct.
So I guess I think the answer is in this region, nobody knows. This is an ansatz, but it's a reasonable ansatz based on information at hand so far. Yeah.
But to base all of this on the black hole, we don't know enough about black holes.
No.
So let's be careful here.
Right. I said it was conjectural. But let me run with the arguments. So I'm not relying on my own arguments at the moment. So I'm reproducing arguments in the literature. Okay. So it's at least many people accept that the scattering then of helicity two modes, two gravitons, i.e. general relativity, will violate polynomial boundedness in some directions in the complex Mandelstam plane, not necessarily for fixed physical momenta transfer, but for some complex values. And just that fact alone means that it isn't a standard local field theory. And Galileans, if we see where do they come from, they are the Lissy zero modes of a massive spin two graviton. So from that point of view, it's not that crazy to imagine that Galileans should also have this violate polynomial boundedness to some extent, because we are dealing intrinsically with gravitational theories. However, we don't want to give up analyticity, because analyticity is what controls macrocausality. If you violate analyticity of the S matrix, then you have then you really have physical problems of things going backwards in time, blowing up exponentially. And so we don't want to violate that. So the best possible conjecture to resolve this particular problem is that Galileans do admit a UV completion with a Rounce invariant S matrix that's unitary, analytic, and crossing symmetric, but you have to give up polynomial boundedness, which is intrinsically saying that the UV completion is not local. And this transforms the previous argument, because without polynomial boundedness, we lose the Poisson-Martin bound. Note actually that GR in gravity, the Poisson-Martin bound is also violated, because you expect the cross section at high energies to grow like the cross section for black holes. So it grows like the cross section goes like energy squared. But in that case, it's attributed to the masslessness. Whereas in the case here, we're arguing that the Poisson-Martin bound is just broken because we haven't got polynomial boundedness anymore. And so if that is the case, even if in the forward scattering limit, if there is a dispersion relation with a finite number of subtractions, the number of subtractions can now be more than 2. So this relates to, so this is, I'm actually arguing that even there still has to be subtractions in this case. And let's suppose just minimalistically that there's one extra subtraction in the dispersion relation, then that transforms the previous argument, because in that case, the first non-zero thing you can actually determine based on unitarity and analyticity is a is the fourth derivative of the amplitude at s equals zero in terms of the cross section. That's my fault. That's because I copied the wrong formula. Just ignore that one. Yeah, so it works if there's a cube here. So because of crossing symmetry, in the massless case, the odd terms vanish, actually. So one extra subtraction is the same as two extra subtractions. So don't worry about that. So the first, in either case, the first non-zero thing you can compute is the fourth derivative. And that has to be positive by the previous argument. But now you change the story, because now I can write down a Galilean operator that reproduces that. And so there's no contradiction between the Galilean symmetry and the analyticity and unitarity, if indeed you have to perform more subtractions. So that's what I'm going to argue, more or less. Now, giving up polynomial boundedness, as I say, means giving up the temperedness assumption of the Wightman axioms. And the temperedness assumption is that the mentor space Wightman functions grow for complex k only as a polynomial. And so this is pushing us into an exponential growth related to John's entire functions. So let's think of the simplest case, just the normal Kalle-Lehmann spectral representation. Imagine we've got two operators, and we compute their vacuum expectation value. Then we know from the Kalle-Lehmann spectral representation, we can write that as a linear superposition of Minkowski space Wightman functions with a given mass. And then rho is basically a distribution of mass. And unitarity requires that this is positive, essentially because this is the square of something. And stability requires that the mass squares are positive, so there's no tachyons.
The point was it's not renormalized, not UV complete.
That was my point, no.
Normal quantum gravity, which I've been working on for a long time, is UV complete, because all the loops are finite.
Yeah, that's not, okay. We can talk later. Let me run to the end. So now, the Wyman function, if you look at its behavior at large values of mu, it either decays exponentially, or it oscillates depending on whether you're looking at space-like or time-like separations. So the convergence of this integral requires that nothing grows faster than an exponential. So now what I'm going to do is use some old 1960s terminology and define for you what are called localizable, quasi-local, and non-localizable fields based on the order of growth of the spectral density. So I'm going to define a parameter alpha, which is the rate at which the spectral density grows exponentially in that prefactor. And there are various different cases. So if you look at the Wyman function, because these grow, these decay exponentially or oscillate, in order for this integral to converge, rho cannot grow faster than a linear exponential in mu, in order for the Wightman function to exist in real space. So in the case where it does exist, that's called a strictly localizable field. So that means that we can actually talk about the local field in position space. The Wightman functions exist as functions. That is a more general case than the polynomial case, which is the temperedness assumption. So for temperedness, you have no exponential growth. So alpha would be zero. You just have a polynomial. That's the normal case. But you can also go to strictly localizable fields where the spectral density grows as an exponential, but where alpha is less than a half. If alpha is less than a half, then this exponentials here will still ensure the convergence of the integral. And so we can still talk about the real space Wightman function. And that defines a so-called strictly localizable field. There is a special case when alpha is exactly a half. And in that case, if you think about it, if alpha is exactly a half, then everything is going like square root of mu at large mu. And so then there will be some regime of convergence of these integrals, but not for all x. So that basically at large distances, there'll be a convergence regime. So that case is called quasi-local because it contains some remnants of locality. But it is still not technically local. And then in the case where alpha is greater than a half, the integral just doesn't converge, and that's non-localizable. So this is old-fashioned terminology.
Typical UV complete theories, like UV.
So I'll get to that. So this terminology was come up with by axiomatic field theory people when they were just thinking what's the most general thing we could possibly do with field theory. And these are obviously, if we don't give up Lorentz invariants, these are the most general things we could imagine. So in the case of the non-localizable fields, if alpha is greater than a half, then it means the position space Wyman function simply does not exist. The momentum space does, but the position space does not exist. And that's the sense of the word non-localizable. It's not that the commutator will not vanish outside the light cone, for example. It's that the commutator does not exist for definite points x and y, because the integral simply doesn't converge. So they're not fundamentally not localizable. But what does exist is if you take test functions and you smear this distribution, then if the test functions fall off sufficiently fast at large k, then the integral always exists. And so what that means is that we're not dealing with tempered distributions anymore. We're dealing with what are called Gelfand-Shelov distributions, which is a valid theory of distributions with just this weaker assumption that they're only defined with test functions that fall off exponentially. Okay. So the idea will be to effectively promote the Wyman function in the Wyman axioms, promote the assumption of temperedness to these Gelfand-Shelov distributions. And that's how you can try and construct a field theory of non-localizable fields. So this is an old idea going back to work in the 60s and so on. In particular, it's been shown that for these kind of field theories, you can have an LSC formalism, cluster decomposition, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a well-defined scattering formalism. And I'm going to tie this in together with more recent ideas from little string theory and in particular, the classicalization proposal that people have suggested in the literature. So in a paper in 99, it was proposed that one should actually think of little string theories as quasi-local field theories. And so the idea is here, what's a little string theory? It's M-theory compactified on T5. So it's a six-dimensional theory. And you can view it as taking a decoupling limit of n coincident five brains in string theory. And the decoupling limit is very much like the massive gravity decoupling limit. You take M Planck to infinity, so you think you're getting rid of gravity. You take G string to zero, but you keep the string scale fixed. And so the decoupling limit retains some features of string theory because you're keeping the string scale fixed. And in particular, it preserves T-duality. Now, the infrared limit of these theories are just six-dimensional superconformal field theories. So there's nothing. So basically, they're effective. In the infrared, they're effective field theories whose leading action is some six-dimensional superconformal field theory. But there can be no UV fixed point. So these are not standard conformal field theories with a UV fixed point because we've kept the string scale fixed. So they retain some inherently non-stringy behavior, which makes it different than field theories. And what is that behavior? Well, it corresponds to an exponential growth of the spectral densities associated with a Hagedorn behavior. So in this case, the spectral density grows as e to the square root of mu, and that corresponds to these definition of quasi-local field theories. So what happens is that there is a scale in these theories, which is basically one square root n over m string, and you can talk about locality at distances larger than that scale, but at distances smaller than that scale, you can't talk about locality anymore. So that's the sense in which they're quasi-local.
What is n?
N is the number of five primes in taking the decoupling limit. So the effective string scale is M string of square root n, basically. So that was a sort of conjectured interpretation of the physics of little string theories. The key point is that they're not local field theories. They're not. Although the infrared limit is a superconformal field theory, the UV limit is not, and there's no UV fixed point. They're somehow fundamentally non-local, the quasi-local, because of this stringy behavior. And another argument along these lines is due to Aronne and Banks. And the idea is, so again, let's think about a normal UV theory like QCD or something. In a normal field theory, if you stick it in finite volume, the typical density of states will grow like the entropy, which will go like e to the d minus 1 over d. And so in any dimension, this thing scales by a power that's less than a linear in energy. And so in that case, if you look at operators whose spectral density grows as the density of states, then you'll find that it'll all be these examples of strictly localizable fields. And then in any local field theory, there will be special operators where the spectral density grows at most by a power, and those are the operators that you build the field theory out of. So in a local, standard local field theory like QCD, all operators that you will talk about will be strictly localizable, which means that you can construct their Whiteman functions. They may not necessarily be tempered, but they will be strictly localizable because this power is less than one. But what was argued by Aharoni Banks is that in a theory of quantum gravity, we would expect the high energy properties to be dominated by the production of black holes. And of course, as we all know, the density of states of black holes grows exponentially with energy, as e to the s. And as you can easily confirm, that growth with energy is also faster than a linear growth in any dimension greater than 3. In fact, in all the cases where you have interesting, you really have gravity. So this grows faster than linear exponential. And that means that if, as they conjectured, that typical operators in such in whatever your picture of quantum gravity is, they had in mind M theory, but it doesn't matter, typical operators will have their spectral density grow exponentially faster than a linear exponential, which puts them in the category of being non-localizable fields. And this fits perfectly with the rule of thumb that in a theory of gravity, there are no local gauge invariant observables. But what we do have are these potentially non-localizable observables. So phrased differently, their conjecture is that the typical spectral density of the operators of interest in a quantum theory of gravity grow exponentially as e times r star of e, where r star is the Schwarzschild radius. And this behavior implies what's called the Giddings-Lippitt bound, locality bound, which they proposed essentially to explain the non-polynomial boundedness of the scattering amplitude for gravitons. Their idea was that you actually just can't talk about locality in gravity at distances less than the Schwarzschild radius associated with a given scattering energy, because what happens if you send in two particles with some total energy E, when the impact parameter is less than the Schwarzschild radius associated with that energy, then you will form a black hole. And the black hole is an extended object. And so this very fact, and as you push the energy up, the black hole gets bigger. So this very fact could not possibly be explained in a local field theory. So their idea was that you really just can't talk about locality as soon as you're in that region. So you can't talk about locality for distances less than the Schwarzschild radius associated with the scattering energy. And this explains the non-polynomial boundedness, conjectured non-polynomial boundedness, the scattering amplitude for gravitons. And that basically ties together precisely with this behavior. You can only talk about locality because of this exponential growth as ER star. You can only talk about locality at distances larger than the associated R star. You can sort of see that qualitatively. So I've just given you that argument. So the picture, if you tie together the picture of the Giddings-Lippitt picture and the Banks picture, Aharoni and Banks, the idea is that what determines the high energy behavior in gravitational theories is the production of black holes. Those in turn have an exponentially growing density of states growing faster than a linear exponential. So that means that the observables in such theories are fundamentally non-localizable. So that means that there is a fundamental bound on locality in these theories, which in turn implies the non-polynomial boundedness of the scattering amplitude. Okay? How long have I got? Ooh. Okay. So what does all this got to do with Galileans? Because aren't Galileans just some scalar field theories that have nothing to do with gravity? And my argument is no. And that's because they have built in the Weinstein mechanism. So just like in general relativity, there is a fundamental scale associated with a given energy, a fundamental length scale associated with energy, at which the Galileans become strongly coupled, which is called the Feinstein radius. So normally in the cosmological context, this is argued along the lines. So Feinstein originally did this for massive gravity, and his idea was, the point was very simple. When the space-time curvature is larger than m squared, you recover general relativity. When the curvature is less than m squared, then you see the fact that you're in some modified theory, and so you have a fifth force propagating. So you ask, at what transition does that occur? And that sets a scale. When the curvature is comparable m squared, that sets the scale, which is the Feinstein radius, which here is written in terms of the Schwarzschild radius and the graviton mass. And what happens then is that inside the Schwarzschild radius, then you have you basically recover general relativity, and outside the Schwarzschild radius, you see that you factor in some modified what did I say? Oh, sorry, the Feinstein radius, that's right. But the Feinstein radius is essentially nothing other than the Schwarzschild radius for the Liszt zero modes in the massive gravity theory. So the normal phrasing of this is, as I've said, is that associated with a source M, like the Earth, it creates a scale around it, which is the Feinstein radius, in which you recover general relativity. So just in terms of the Galilean language, this scale, the Feinstein radius is 1 over lambda times the cube root of m over m Planck, assuming you couple to matter in a standard 1 over m Planck suppressed way. However, you could rewrite this. If you compute that creates the source creates a Galilean field configuration. And if you compute the Galilean field configuration, you find it has a finite classical self-energy, which is already interesting in itself, because if you remember the origin of before people talked about quantum field theory, the original UV divergence problem was the lack of finite self-energy for the electron. And in this theory, the self-energy is actually finite, because essentially in the Feinstein region, the behavior of the field gets cut off in a way that the energy remains finite. And so you can phrase this is the energy of the Galilean computed in terms of the Feinstein radius. And so rewriting this, the Feinstein radius scales as energy to the power of 1/5. And this is the more appropriate way to think about the Feinstein radius for scattering problems. So again, the analogy is such that we know, of course, when two high-energy particles collide, they produce a black hole. And in general relativity, it's the Schwarzschild radius that sets the degree of the region of non-locality. But in, say, a theory like massive gravity, you also have a black hole has a bigger radius, not its helicity two-part, but its helicity zero mode. It has an effectively bigger radius, which is the Feinstein radius, which scales like e to the fifth in four dimensions. And so it is natural, given the gravitational interpretation of these theories, it's natural to imagine that there's some inherently gravitational non-locality out to that larger energy scale. And in fact, this is also connected with the classicalization idea of Duvall et al. And their idea is that in this theory, basically there could exist theories motivated by the gravitational picture, where what happens when you scatter two very high energy particles is you preferentially produce many soft quanta, such that the number of those quanta is the energy of the incoming state times what there is called the classicalization radius R star, but that classicalization radius is exactly the Feinstein radius. So in fact, that's how their picture applied to the Galilean, that's the picture of how unitarity gets recovered at energies above the scale lambda, is that what happens is you preferentially produce in scattering many soft quanta, and the typical energy of one of those soft quanta is E over N, which goes like 1 over R star, which is the Feinstein radius associated with the incoming energy. And so the final density of states will grow exponentially with those number of quanta, which goes like E to the R star of E, which fits in precisely with the story that I've told you so far.
Moon collide, then you're going to have like a exponential, I mean, effectively a black hole in terms of this.
I know you're used to thinking about Feinstein for sort of cosmological applications.
Yeah.
But it's confusing to do that because then you're really thinking about, you know, bound states of many particles. So it's much easier just to think about scattering two Galilean quanta at very high energies. So this picture is the one appropriate to scattering just two Galilean quanta at very, very high energies.
But
so you're not scattering
macroscopic objects, you're saying that's...
For macroscopic objects, then it's much harder. You have to account for the sort of background Weinstein screening from the background source, and it's more complicated. So I'm not saying this is true for macroscopic objects. This is the picture for just scattering quanta, just two quanta. We can talk about that later. Okay, so my claim is that the classicalization picture is also consistent with this effectively exponential growth in the density of states in which the effective entropy scales like ER star for Galileans in D dimensions is equal to that. And so in fact, if this classicalization picture makes sense, then they also, the fields that classicalize are also fundamentally non-localizable field theories. And so in the classicalization picture, instead of black holes, you have what are called classicalons, which is some kind of bound state of n particles, which is argued to be produced in the high energy scattering. And similarly, they will have an exponentially large density of states, leading to non-localizable observables, leading to a locality bound now set by not the Schwarzschild radius, but the Weinstein radius, or the classicalization radius, leading to a non-polynomially bounded scattering amplitude. Okay, so this is the conjecture that Galileans are non-localizable quantum fields whose spectral density grows with e to the e r star, where this is this particular power in d dimensions. Okay, so that is my conjecture that fits all the previous story together. However, we can actually just prove this conjecture is true for one specific Galilean model. And so that, I'm going to sketch that quickly because I'm running out of time. But to do the proof, we use the Galilean duality transformation, which is a map between different Galilean models. It's a non-trivial, non-local field redefinition that maps two distinct Galilean models into each other that was recently pointed out. And so that... the duality transformation itself is as follows. So if pi is your original Galilean field, suppose I define the following combination of coordinates and the field, then I define the same by the inverse of that transformation like this, and define the dual Galilean field. So the map between these two is a very nonlinear field-dependent coordinate transformation. But nevertheless, this map is technically invertible.
Late to lunch, or?
I'll show you what it is we're actually going to do. Okay. Yeah, so there's some assumptions in using this formula. But under this transformation, d mu pi is d tilde mu pi tilde, and this is what it looks like more explicitly at the level of the fields. And these formula aren't particularly helpful, but I'll give you a more explicit formula of what I mean by the duality map. But under that transformation, what happens is a given Galilean Lagrangian with coefficients C2, C3, C4, C5, and this is just from the Wess-Zumino type terms, but it's also true for the infinite number of other terms, will map into another Galilean in terms of the dual field with different choices of coefficients in which there is a simple relationship between those coefficients. And there are many ways, different ways to understand where this symmetry comes from, either from bigravity, either from a coset construction for the Galilean symmetry, but it's now at the classical level, it's an established fact. And because it's true at the classical level, then it means that the tree amplitudes of this theory are identical to the tree amplitudes of that theory. And you can just show that quite easily for the first few scattering amplitudes. And what that means is that I can choose one of these theories to be a free theory. But if I just choose, that means just corresponds to switching on the two coefficient, having the rest zero. Well, let me do it for this one. If I just switch on C2 and have the rest zero, then I have a free theory. But then the other theory will be have non-zero coefficients. So it'd be some non-trivial Galilean model, whose S matrix will still be trivial. So you might be disappointed because the S matrix is still trivial, but we can still look at the Wightmann functions of that theory. And we can reasonably conjecture that the Wightmann functions of that theory, which is dual to a free theory, so whose S matrix is trivial, have the same qualitative property of the Wightmann functions of the general interacting Galilean model, and that's what we're going to do. So for this theory, what it is under this map, I'm now going to call rho the dual free Galilean field, and pi the interacting Galilean field, and the Lagrangian for the Galilean, which is dual to a free field in any dimensions, is just this determinant structure times d pi squared, and that's dual to a free theory with d rho squared. No, that's d. That's the matrix d pi. Yeah, that's the matrix d pi. Okay. So just to remind you, if you take that theory, it really is true if you compute the scattering amplitudes that it is equivalent to a free theory, even though it doesn't look like a free theory. But you can show that explicitly term by term, up to, of course, the ambiguities of renormalization counter terms. So what we really mean is that this plus a set of counterterms in a given regularization scheme is equivalent to a free theory, but there are a set of counterterms for which that is true. So to quantize this one free theory, I'm going to use a more explicit form of the duality, where it looks essentially like this. And to derive this, essentially, we just do a Fourier transform in its inverse and use those formulae in the map. And so this is really what I mean by the duality transformation. And it's now one-to-one in the sense, as long as this integral converges for a given rho, I can compute pi. And the inverse of this is something similar to that. So this explicitly, if you expand it out, will reproduce the perturbative Galilean duality transformation, which leaves the S matrix invariant. But this is a nice explicit non-perturbative form for that map. So my definition of the quantized theory is just going to run with this, promoting this to the operator level, and choosing to normal order this expression. So remember that rho is a free field, so there's no question how to quantize that guy. And pi is an interacting field whose S matrix is free, but whose off-shell Whiteman functions are non-trivial. And this is how we promote the definition of the operator. And so to convince you I'm doing something sensible, I have to show you that I can actually calculate something with this, albeit rather formal expression, perform the integrals, and make something finite. Now, of course, I am using normal ordering. Normal ordering is implicitly removing of such an exponential is implicitly removing an infinite number of divergences. But as I said, the duality between the theories does require adding an infinite number of counterterms within a given regularization scheme. And what this is saying is that this particular, the normal ordering here actually gives the unique answer for how to do that. And in fact, you can show, I won't do it here, but you can show non-perturbatively that the S matrix, using this as your definition of your field, is in fact trivial for this theory, as it should be. So that prescription is well motivated, because if we, for example, if we take a coherent state for the rho field, so for which the rho expectation between two coherent states would look something like this, then the sandwich between those two coherent states, the vacuum expectation value for pi, will just be the classical coherent state, which is automatically a solution of the Galilean equation of motion, the interacting Galilean equation of motion, because this is just the classical duality formula, which you can show it would satisfy the equation of motion. Okay, so the normal ordering prescription appears to be reasonable in the sense that it preserves the classical limit is recovered in the sense that when you look at the operator between a coherent state, you get the classical solution of the equations of motion. So this, we should say this definition is somewhat formal. The reason being is that for these theories, this is non-localizable theory. So this thing actually won't exist in real space. So what we really mean is that the Fourier transform of this will exist. So its momentum space realization will exist. But I'm just going to use this naive expression to motivate the actual calculation of the spectral density. And so if you just run naively and you look at this, you look at the two-point function of the two fields, then you have this two-point function between these two normal ordered products. And the key point is that these things don't really matter too much. The essential point is these exponentials. If you dot product these two exponentials, then by Wick's theorem, it just gives you this particular combination. And you end up, for an elementary calculation, just with this particular integral. Now, these integrals don't converge, and neither should they, because I've told you this, that what will happen is that the Galilean field will be non-localizable, which means its position space will not exist. But it will exist in momentum space, so I'm simply using this as a formal trick to derive the momentum space form. And we'll see that the spectral density in momentum space is an entire function, so there's no question about the convergence.
Sorry, you're saying that if it's not localizable, then in positional space, correlations don't exist.
That's right. So this doesn't exist, but this guy does. Okay. So what it means is I should really put test functions on here and then evaluate it between test functions. But nobody ever uses test functions, right? That's just how you formally say it. It's much easier just to go into momentum space and compute this quantity. So if I take that integral with some simplifications, expand it out perturbatively, and this is justified after the fact, and you compute each of those integrals, you can do it, and you get this nice sum, and the sum is convergent, it's an entire function, and the entire function grows exponentially with the promised power of mu to the 3/5, which in terms of energy is energy to the 6/5, which is precisely E times R star, where R star is the Weinstein radius. So this spectral density grows exponentially as promised as E to the E times R star.
Free theory or not quantum mechanically equivalent to free theory? What's the claim?
It's quantum mechanically equivalent to a free theory. The S matrix is trivial, and you can prove that. These are the off-shell Wyman functions.
When you do standard field theory, local field theory, you do perturbation theory, you weak order everything. But the weak ordering depends on the commutators vanishing in space-like surfaces. There are some subtle things going on here. When you go from standard field theory, which is strictly local, to entire functions, exponential growth, you have to be very careful about how you do field theory.
That's right, but I'm not doing perturbation theory, I'm just explicitly evaluating the Wyman function of this operator, and it grows exponentially. There's no ambiguity here.
Okay, so I'm issuing after 26.
That's right, you're thinking about how am I going to undo loops and some interacting version of this theory.
Yeah.
But this is a free theory, and you can prove that it's free. This is a free theory, you can prove that it's free, because there is an LSE formalism for these fields. You can prove it's free. My point is that consistent with these previous conjectures about non-locality and gravity is that the spectral density of the Galilean operators grows exponentially. So that means that this particular Galilean field, and I think quite reasonably all Galilean fields, because this is just from the classical point of view, there's no particular difference between this and all the other ones, although quantum mechanically they're different because of the S matrix. But this is that all Galilean fields will have this property, maybe not with the same coefficient, but with the same exponential order of growth. What happens is that in that sum, in the Cullen-Lehmann spectral representation, this is the normal pole piece. This piece, where it's coming from, is intermediate quantum mechanical states with n particles. It gets picked by n particles, where n grows with energy like this, is E r star, and so that's precisely consistent with the classicalization proposal. So that at the very least, this Galilean, which is dual to a free field theory, is indeed a non-localizable field.
Could I use the same argument to argue that a free theory is non-localizable?
That's right. So you have a duality. And again, this was known in the 70s. You can have a duality between a non-localizable theory and a localizable theory.
Free theories can be interpreted as either.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
But you have a non-local transformation, right? This non-local.
But this is, remember, this is off-shell. So the off-shell physics is different. The on-shell is the same.
Well, no, but the point is that if you have a free theory, but then you do some non-local field redefinition, I guess the non-local field redefinition, then of course you have a non-local theory now.
Maybe
you
just written in a non-local language.
Well, it's non-local. So that's
right.
It really doesn't change the physics.
No, the physics is the same, but it's not
right.
Local anymore. So I don't know, it seems that all that's happening.
Yeah, but the on-shell physics is the same. So the S matrix there is trivial. The point is that in that representation, it's a Galilean model, not a free theory. And the conjecture I'm making, which I'm filling in, is that the exponential growth of the Wyman functions of that particular model carries over to the general Galilean model. That appears very reasonable based on just semi-classical reasoning. But if that is true for the general interacting Galilean model, then in that case, it really just is a non-localizable field, in which case the S matrix, when it's not trivial, will be the S matrix of a non-localizable field. And this exponential growth of the Whiteman functions kicks into the exponential growth of the scattering amplitude in some direction in the complex Mandelstam plane, which means that the scattering S matrix is not polynomial bounded, which is my conjecture. Okay, so a toy example, which is not a Galilean, but something to give you an idea of what it is we're saying, of an explicit S matrix, which is unitary and everything else, is given by this asymptotic fragility scenario in the low energy effective field theory of infinitely long strings. So let's just take the Namagoto action, and we choose a gauge so that it basically, you can think of it in d dimensions. If we've got a d-dimensional target space, then there's d minus 2 xi's. And what you do is you take, in this paper, it was considered the Namagoto with the wrong sign for the string scale squared. So you switch the sign here and here. And this wrong signness corresponds in the low energy effective field theory to getting superluminal propagation, very much like you would get in the Galilean model, which has also been used as an argument to say that these theories can't be UV completed. But in this case, you can show that there is a Weinstein radius. So if you take the energy of a given configuration, then that will scale like LS squared times R star. And so equivalently, there is the Weinstein radius in this system grows with energy. But you can actually write down the exact unitary crossing symmetric analytic S matrix. So for just 2-2 scattering, this is in two dimensions. The world sheet is two-dimensional. So the exact S matrix is a pure phase shift, and it's just equal to this. It's an exponential, and it's manifestly, there's a branch cut across the real axis. It's manifestly unitary, because if you take the complex conjugate, you get from this to this. It's manifestly crossing symmetric, because when you do S goes to minus S, you also switch across the branch cut. But what it satisfies is it's non-polynomially bounded because of that minus there. So this is the formula in the upper half complex S plane. So if I add to S a plus I, then this will grow exponentially as you go up. It'll grow exponentially that way and decay exponentially that way. And that's the difference between having LS squared of this sign versus the normal sign. So in the normal Namagoto string, you'll have it'll be polynomially bounded. When you switch the sign, it grows, it's non-polynomially bounded, which ties together with the superluminality in the low energy effective field theory. But nevertheless, this S matrix is unitary crossing symmetric analytic in Lorentz invariants. In other words, it satisfies everything else you would want to satisfy an S matrix to satisfy. So I guess I'm going over, sorry about that, but my argument is that analyticity alone ensures macrocausality. And it's that will ultimately remove any meaningful superluminal propagation in these theories, because one can argue that as long as you maintain the analyticity assumption, the commutator, if you take two, although remember that the commutator doesn't actually exist in real space, but if you take two test functions which are localized at a given point, then what you can argue is that the commutator between two test functions which are localized at different points will go to zero as those points become infinitely far space-like apart. And ultimately, that will imply an absence of actual meaningful superluminal propagation, because if you really have superluminalities, the light cone will be bigger arbitrarily far out. And that comes from analyticity.
You say this is still non-zero outside the light cone or no?
So the point is it doesn't exist in real space, so you have to smooth it.
Yeah.
Now, in a local field,
this little bit of paper, which you,
that's
let's
right.
Say, let's say we believe it for the moment.
Right.
Is it zero or non-zero outside the light cone?
You have to ask the right question. You have to smooth it with a test function. And then
yes.
Even in a local field theory, it'll be non-zero outside the light cone, because you have to choose a test function of a finite support. Okay. Okay. So that's the summary. So, as I argued, there's these arguments that the low energy effective field theory for Galileans cannot be UV completed with a local Lorentz invariant theory. And what I've argued is that the potential way around that is to imagine that these are fundamentally non-localizable. And there are arguments that gravitational theories should basically satisfy this property, essentially because of the exponentially growth in density of states associated with black holes. And what I've given you is one explicit UV quantization of a theory that's classically equivalent to a Galilean model whose S matrix is trivial, in which you can show precisely this exponentially growing density of states, which forbids us from talking about truly strictly local observables in that theory. So whilst I haven't written you down what the explicit S matrix looks like, because obviously that would be extremely difficult, if you give up the polynomial boundedness, there appears to be no obstruction to UV completing the theory along this lines, where you really do have, you still maintain unitarity, crossing symmetry, analyticity, Lorentz invariance, but you give up polynomial boundedness. I shall end there. Sorry for going over. Okay, somebody other than John, because.
So I'm wondering how much progress you can make thinking about the features of the scattering matrix at the classical level. I mean, there must be something really important about shell nature, because if you took a spherical wave and collapsed it, I know from experience you don't form a bound object as I would say in GR, where I can take a gravitational wave and collapse it into a black hole. You get points in space time where the equations of motion become real posts and you can't evolve past those points, and then you're here. And you do that before you form any kind of bound object. So I mean, in the GR case, it seems like I could make at least a little bit of progress understanding these issues by scattering gravitational waves from a black hole, for example, or something similar. So I'm curious, in this context, could you make any progress at the classical level, or is it really quantum mechanical, you know, by nature, I need to look at the off-shell nature of this matrix to make any kind of progress, or do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think, so in the context of the classicalization picture, people have made attempts along those lines as to sort of understand the emergence of some kind of semi-classical field configuration that classically resolves the scattering. But really, this mechanism is fundamentally quantum, so it's different. So I think the problem with the classical picture is you're only ever going to go up to the point where the effective field theory breaks down. And unlike GR, that's before you hit any horizon or anything like that. That's the thing. So GR is nice because the horizon prevents you from seeing the effective field theory breaking down. Sure. But these theories, that's not, you know, there's no horizon. The Weinstein radius. The Weinstein radius is there, and you can go up to it. And then what'll happen is the effective field. Exactly. The effective field theory will break down at a point where you can go all the way up to. Right. There's also the singular solutions as well. Yeah.
Sure, but yeah. At least in that case, you can write down solutions that are sensibly well defined everywhere except for at the Big Bang singularity.
Same right. With the Galilean. Yeah. Point where you just can't resolve anymore.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean there are solutions where for the Galilean where it's well defined at all time. An effective field never breaks down, right?
Yeah. Generically, no. Yes.
Right.
You can write down solutions.
It warms my heart to hear all this. I've been trying to sell non-local quantum field theory and non-local quantum gravity for 26 years, mostly to deaf ears. And the point is that when you go this route.
Yeah, but I'm doing something different. So I'm not using. So what you do is you try and use the non-locality to resolve the loops in perturbation theory.
Well, just resolve quantum gravity.
To regulate them, yeah. But regulate loops. That's not what's happening here. So the loop behavior is not any better. Perturbation theory still breaks down.
No, but the point is that your loops are going to be controlled by.
No, they're not controlled. They're not controlled. No.
So I think he's using the wrong sign for that. Everything is blowing up exponentially.
The loops are not controlled.
But if it's not controlled, why are you doing it?
because perturbation, we're not using it to resolve the divergences in perturbation theory.
But that's the main problem of gravity. How do you make the theory finite?
Right, but that's another problem. That's not the problem I'm solving.
Well, maybe it should be the problem you're solving.
Okay.
So can I ask something?
We've been trying to solve this problem for 30 years.
Right, but it's not the problem I'm talking about. So
all of this were known that, like, very least known that back in 2006 when Adam the Tom wrote, 2007, I don't know, when Adam the Tom said that, like, BGP type things are not to be accomplished.
That's right.
Didn't we already know that gravity has a similar type of law? Or I don't know, or maybe it was.
No, so, yeah, I mean, gravity breaks the Poisson bound, but it otherwise respects the analyticity and perturbatively respects.
So why then did they expect BGP to respect Poisson bound, even though?
The argument was when you take M Planck to infinity, you really just have what looks like a local field theory, right? The Lagrangian for the Galilean that you get from DGP looks like a local field theory. Okay. So the argument is you could treat that as a local field theory, and then you run through the argument, and then you find that it isn't a local field theory.
Okay, but then somehow they argue that it cannot be UV complete and Lorentz invariant, even though with new gravity had the same problem. So somehow, I mean, that assumption must too simplistic, and that's somehow you account for that.
The assumption was that taking M Planck to infinity removed the gravitational aspect.
Right.
So you could treat it on the same terms, yeah.
But I guess the conclusion is that even that doesn't remove the gravitational aspect.
That's the point I'm making more.
Yeah.
Because the Weinstein radius is really is like the Schwarzschild radius for this zero mark. So I'm saying that taking M Planck to infinity does not get rid of the gravitational non-locality, that there is a non-locality in, say, massive gravity, which survives out to the Weinstein radius. And taking M Planck to infinity doesn't remove that.
What problem can you solve?
John, I'm going to ban you. I'm sorry.
Do you know if these 60 superconformal theories exhibit any kind of classical solution that would foreshadow like the Weinstein mechanism?
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. So
like more or less all superconformals have been clipped.
Right.
No scale.
It's not really. The difference with those in the quasi-local case.
You would need to include the leading sort of irrelevant operators, I guess.
In the quasi-local case, the Weinstein scale does not grow with energy because it's a fixed, because it's precisely at the borderline where R star is a constant. So the perturbation theory breaks down at the Weinstein radius, whereas opposed to, say, a Galilean, you can argue R star is bigger than, can be bigger than 1 over lambda. So that's the difference.
All
right.
Since we're over, why don't we continue over lunch, and again, dinner at 6 o'clock in the Bistro.